Welcome, everybody, to A Galaxy Not So Far Away, a Mysterious Galaxy podcast. I'm Gary.
And I'm Becca.
And today with us we have Jenny.
Hello.
Victoria.
Hello.
And Nick.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, everyone. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah. Awesome. That's fun. I'm very excited about today's episode, actually. Today,
oh my God, me too.
We're talking about adaptations. So, specifically books that have gone on to become, I put movies and TV shows in the doc, but, like, video games, I think, is also an option because we have The Witcher out here. Are there other, outside of Witcher, are there other books that have become video games?
They're very rare.
Books that have become video games.
Usually it'd be like a book that became a movie, then maybe become a video game.
Oh, I guess there's Lord of the Rings video games.
Oh,
right?
There we go.
Shadow of Mordor.
Yeah, see, there we go.
And I think, like Harry Potter has some video
they
games
do,
out there.
Yeah.
The Harry Potter Lego games are very fun.
Also, yeah. I mean, we were just talking the other day about Assassin's Creed and how that's like a loose adaptation of
like myths,
mythology.
And stuff. Yeah, totally. I think Odyssey does that, but I think that's the only one that actually pulls from like mythological creatures and things, because the rest of them are much more historical. I don't say historically accurate, but historically based.
Well, there's also the Alice McGee's take on Alice in Wonderland, or America McGee's Alice in Wonderland books, video games.
Oh. I don't know those.
Oh, they're so creepy.
They're so good. I love them.
Nice.
There is a video game for The Great Gatsby.
Excuse me?
There is?
Wow.
Yes. It is on, on the internet.
Oh.
So I will find a link. It's pretty fun.
Well, there is also...
I hate The Great Gatsby, but I like the game.
There's also detective video games based off of, like, Sherlock Holmes Agatha Christie books.
There's, Lovecraftian horror video games, too.
Oh, yeah. There was Call of Cthulhu. And
yeah.
They did another one that was, like, called The Sunken City or something like that.
Yeah, that one's kind of recent, right?
Yeah, that came out, I think, last year.
I think so, too. I didn't play it, but I heard it was all right.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot more hype about it, especially Comic-Con and E3 last couple years. But when the game came out, it was like, oh, okay, let's move on.
I mean, I know that nobody has brought it up, but I will just say, too, there are so many comic book video games.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Oh, yeah. Like... dozens. I mean, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Marvel versus Capcom, you know, the list goes on.
I think video game adaptations of comic books are probably the most prolific as far as, like, stories becoming video games.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I don't have a PlayStation, but I heard that the most recent Spider-Man game for PS4 was great.
Scott has it, and he loved that. He played that game so much that I got tired of seeing Spider-Man.
We kept coming really close to, like, making a terrible financial decision and buying the, like, Spider-Man PS4 with the game. And, like, I had to just keep being like, no, we will regret it when the high comes down.
Yeah, that's fair. I also had... a big moment of, like, can I justify buying this console when this is the only game I'll probably play on it? And instead I ended up watching, like, someone put together all the cutscenes like it's a movie. And so I ended up watching,
that's cool,
like, a couple hours of the beginning of the game, and then I was like, I'm done with this.
Well, I guess that's proof then that it was good that you didn't buy it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. There's so many. I mean, like, I think we already spent time in early episodes talking a lot about Harry Potter, but, like, that's the biggest... Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings are probably the biggest, like, adaptations of, like, novels to, like, franchise movies,
right? Oh, definitely,
right?
Definitely. I think so.
Definitely became the biggest.
I can't think of anything else that had the same sort of... I guess Twilight also had, like, a huge impact in the same way.
And technically, they had video games, too.
Yeah.
But,
They did. Yeah.
Oh, they did.
I mean, as far as YA goes, like, you know, Maze Runner, Hunger Games. The Hunger Games, Twilight,
Percy Jackson.
YA novels are constantly being adapted into film right now.
So, my impression, at least when I was, you know, I worked at a movie theater in, like, the early 2010s, and, well, through most of the 2010s, actually, but when I was working there, the last couple of Harry Potter movies were still yet to come out, and it was interesting seeing, like, a lot of those adaptations start, like, a lot of different film companies trying to, I think, cash in on that phenomenon of, like, young adult readers who are willing to come out at midnight and spend money on movie tickets and watch them several times and whatever. And, like, other than Twilight, I can't think of any other ones that hit quite as hard. Like, yeah, a ton of people came out to see Hunger Games and it made a lot of money, but we didn't have kids lined up 3 days early.
I mean, I'm just gonna keep saying it because I am the comic book person here, but, you know, I feel like the only other thing you really see that big of a fanatical response to are, like, the MCU movies specifically, like...
Absolutely.
I had to line up to see Black Panther, like, an hour and a half before it, on a Sunday, 2 weeks after it had come out.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. It's, like, it's... It gets crazy. And the tickets sell out so fast for those two.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, I think we got our tickets for Endgame 3 hours after they were released, and the first time we could see it was, like, a Sunday at 10 a.m.
Yeah, we waited quite a while to go see that, because I was like, no, I can't do it.
I had the benefit, up until recently, I had the benefit of, like, I still worked there when most of the... I think the only one I had to buy a ticket for was Endgame. I think I was still at the theater when Infinity War came out. And even that was, like... I knew that if I wanted to see it in the first weekend, I had to go to, like, a regular 3D show in the middle of the day because no one buys tickets for 3D shows. The IMAX ones, the Dolby ones, those big formats, and then all the standard shows would sell out immediately.
I mean, while we're on the topic, too, I had written down some notes about the MCU movies.
Yeah.
Specifically, something that's always been really interesting to me is how different the film adaptations of certain plot lines are. Like, the one that instantly comes to mind for me is the Civil War comics versus the movie.
Thank you.
I mean, we were robbed of amazing characters. Like, we didn't get Hercules, we didn't get She-Hulk, Luke Cage, Reed Richards. I mean, the entire Young Avengers team was part of the first Civil War comic series. But, like, I will say that I absolutely think that they got it 100% right between Tony and Captain America. And Steve. Yes, thank you.
Do you think because the nature of comic books of being, like, a story told over multiple issues for months spanning, like, it's hard. I don't think you can get a one-to-one adaptation the same way you can get when you take a book and you adapt it to a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Something I was going to touch on, and I guess I'll do it now since it has segued so beautifully, is, you know, with books, I feel like you usually can see an increase in sales and interest in novels when there's movie and television adaptations. But generally speaking, in the comic industry, you almost never see that sort of response to, like, the comic series for films and television that come out. The one real exception for that is the Watchmen comic series. The sales for that skyrocketed after the film came out. And I think a lot of that has to do with, like, the daunting number of back issues, you know, alternate universes, characters that are not brought up at all in the film adaptations. Like, She-Hulk was a huge character in the original Civil War comic series and wasn't in it at all in the film because she hadn't been introduced.
Yeah.
And so I think that for people that don't read comics, when they look at, you know, maybe picking up, like, oh, you know, Civil War, I saw that movie, I liked it. And then they see how different it is.
Yeah.
It's really, like, scary to them. Like, it's a lot of daunting information.
I mean, comic books can be intimidating. Like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
As someone who reads them, but, like you're saying, especially I think with the alternate universes, people don't even know where to start.
And I think it's, like, the big two are the most intimidating. Like, Marvel and DC have so much.
Yeah.
Like, the one exception I can think of is, I mean, the Suicide Squad comics, while they've been around a while, like, the comics that they used to loosely adapt the Suicide Squad film are very accessible and easy to understand. Like, the setup and the premise and everything is much better done in the comics. Sure. But it's the same sort of guys, you know, that they present in the film, so...
I also feel like with how you were saying some of the Marvel movies are missing certain characters, that also ties into the fact who owns them. Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to get Hulk characters from a Disney Marvel movie.
You're absolutely right. Like,
but the issue is when they were being made.
Yeah, Disney Universal could only use them.
Disney could only use them if they weren't the title character. And it was the same with the X-Men characters. They can maybe have them trickle in a little bit, but they couldn't really be there.
Well, that's what...
Oh, absolutely. There was so much discourse about Spider-Man being brought in.
Exactly. That's why he was so late in getting to any of the movies, is because of that. Because
Sony had the rights.
Yeah.
Right? And it's the same with, like, the Fantastic Four and... the X-Men, like, that's why, you know, Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are not quote-unquote X-Men in the Avengers.
Yeah. And just for a little financial perspective as well, when Disney purchased the Marvel Universe rights, that was in 2009, and they bought it for $4 billion, and in the last decade have seen, like, closer to $20 billion in profit.
That's because pretty much Disney can just snap do whatever and make they a want. Movie gold.
Yeah, they can.
Like,
they can
people are going to pay for a Disney film no matter what.
And that's all we're going to say about that, because well. I'm terrified of Disney, and I respect them.
We all love the mouse.
All hail the mouse. I love how this segued into, like, just comic books. Like, comic book
adaptation. Well, that's what I'm here for. They're a huge part of, like, an adaptation world.
Well, especially now. Yeah, for sure.
Wait. We lost Gary.
What?
We did lose Gary.
How did we lose Gary? Oh, my God.
Did we?
I was like, there's no way that he is not talking for this long.
Did.
Gary. The mouse got him.
I was going to say, the mouse Thanos snapped him.
What is the last thing you remember?
Before we got Thanos snapped.
We were talking about rights of movie characters being in different studios.
Oh, okay, no.
Wow.
That was where
we lost you a while ago.
Well, yeah, that's where I vanished.
Well, maybe let's move beyond that. That
long ago.
Let's maybe move beyond that.
Yeah.
Let's just... We started talking about Disney and things got a little... I was like, we gotta stop talking about the mouse.
Things got a little mousy.
So, well, next topic. What happens,
because I'll have all the audio from y'all. True. I'll figure it out.
Because I have a huge, not a huge, but a good list of just even movies and TV shows. Yeah,
we had a lot to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And I think some of Nick's and mine are totally going to overlap, because I know we're both going to talk about gaming.
That makes sense.
Yes, but I also have some alternatives just in case.
I have some alternatives. I can bring in some adaptation theory.
Oh, that's fun.
Anyone cares about that.
Jenny, are you the one that left the note about...
Yeah, I realized I didn't put my name there.
Yeah, I was very confused. I was like, why is this part of the introduction?
Sorry. I don't know how to talk about this stuff.
No, but it's fine.
A lot of my dissertation was on adaptation. And
that's fascinating.
Adaptation theory, so.
Oh, really cool.
I can explain theoretical concepts. Maybe. But we also don't have to talk about that. I always feel weird being like, well, I studied this. And it seemed less weird to do it ahead of time than in the middle of a podcast.
No, right? Absolutely.
Do you want
Is there anything
give
in particular
us,
you want to?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Gary and I were going to say the same thing.
I mean, no, the only things that, like, I can talk about, like, is kind of how adaptations work psychologically.
Oh.
Like,
how do they do that?
Very interesting.
Should I just start talking?
Yeah.
Do it.
Are we are? Okay. So one of the things that, like, I guess is probably the easiest thing to understand is that adaptations are cultural artifacts, right, if you want to call them, that contain multiple temporalities within them. And the more simple way of saying that is...
I was like, what does that mean?
Multiverse?
Yes, kind of.
Woo!
You have the original text, and then you have the adapted text. And the adapted text only, or not only, but has added meaning because of the original text, but also the time that took place in between the production of the original text and the secondary text.
Mm.
So wow. Any cultural events or kind of massive shifts in ideology and stuff like that changes the way a character is going to be portrayed.
Sure.
In frame of references. Then,
exactly. So
we talked a little bit in the last episode when we were doing like myths, we talked about like retellings and people like retelling the same myth in different formats over and over. And like, I think that that's a similar playing in a similar space.
No. Yeah. So that's what kind of gives it meaning. But then the other thing that like, so that's the back end of it. But then the other end, Becca talked a lot in that episode about kind of people seeing Hercules and that being kind of their point of reference for that Greek myth. And if that's the first time you've encountered that myth, that's always going to have some sort of origin about it for you individually.
Mm.
And so even if you're going back to read the quote unquote original, that original is in some ways an adaptation of your experience of the Disney's Hercules.
Yeah. You're totally going to have not whether intentionally or not, but like whether you mean to bring that baggage to it or not, you're going to have like that prior experience in
exactly
when you're consuming whatever the new thing is or the original thing is.
I actually really love that you said that, Jenny, because it made sense of like I talked briefly about how when I read a lot of fan fiction, then I like see the character differently in my head when I go back to watch the actual material, the canonical material. And that had just happened to me like yesterday. Like I was like watching like a clip of like Adam Driver speaking, and I was like, he sounds not like that in my head anymore. And I was like, this is because I've like morphed his voice into something different in my head from all of the other material I've been consuming around characters he's played. But yeah, I didn't know that was an actual thing. I just thought that I was like crazy.
No, it's totally.
I mean, you are, but for a different
reason. You know what, Victoria?
I never said I was sane either, so we're all good.
You know what? Fair.
We're all mad here.
Oh my God.
And that, I mean, one of the other things that we talked about with myths and fairy tales and stuff, and if you go back, there's a lot of sexism in.
Yeah.
Myths. I mean, this is kind of even just surface, right? And then you kind of see how these characters have evolved through adaptations. They're figured very differently. And it's not a myth, but like one of the people I wrote about a lot is Ophelia from Hamlet,
who is
barely in Hamlet. Like her number of lines is very small. But her character has kind of become an object of study and kind of an object of focus in different adaptations that change how it's acted and change the character's history and give it a history that wasn't necessarily in Shakespeare's version of Hamlet. And that's not a bad thing. That's a cool thing, right? And how we can keep using different media and different, you know, contexts that give new meaning and sort of in some senses rewrite histories that may have been not the best.
Yeah. I think stuff like that is important too, to like take a look at those stories that we've been retelling for forever, right? Decades, centuries, millennia, and be able to approach it with a more modern lens and be able to tell those stories in a way that is more inclusive, more aware of itself, maybe.
Sorry, I don't mean to butt in, but I was desperately trying to remember this because when you said Ophelia, it reminded me.
The Simpsons?
No, there's a video game, and it was drawn by, it was drawn by the creator of the, like, Nimona?
Oh, yeah.
Noelle Stevenson, excuse me, my God. She also did the most recent She-Ra and the Princess of Power. That is like a choose-your-own-adventure Hamlet retelling, basically.
That's rad.
And Ophelia is like this hilarious, sassy character in it. And like a lot of other artists worked on it as well. And Ryan North, who wrote for Squirrel Girl, he also wrote the game. And I love it. Like, I had to study Shakespeare a lot in high school, being part of the thespian program for theater. And so I've always, like, leaned towards, like, humorous retellings and adaptations like that for, I don't know.
What was the name of the game?
It's To Be or Not To Be. You can buy it on Steam for $5.
That's fun.
And it works with, like, all platforms.
If we're going to talk about hilarious Ophelia, I always, every time I think of the character Ophelia, I think of the Simpsons episode where they did Hamlet, and Lisa is Ophelia, and someone does something, and Ophelia goes, "No one out crazies Ophelia," and then she just cartwheels out of the room, go boop, 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 and then into the lake, and she just cartwheels into the lake, and that's it.
Wow. Incredible.
Oh, I know. That's going to stick with me forever.
I love it.
That's
the problem is all of her lines are in the scene where she's kind of singing and is very much literally declared a document in madness. Even though everybody's been calling Hamlet crazy the entire play, she shows up and she's singing, and that is not good for them.
No.
Which we don't need to get into the details of Hamlet, but it's just, I don't know, I like the way that, like with the Simpsons example, like you can use different genres and move it into these different spaces through adaptation, and that always adds something and says something different, I think, when adaptation is successful, at least, that's what it's doing, and that's what's cool about it.
The last thing I'll say about Shakespeare adaptations specifically, because they are so popular, is, I mean, I see it now, like, I'll be scrolling through the For You page on TikTok, and I'll see, like, kids making, like, funny videos about, like, different, like, stuff that happens in Shakespeare plays.
Oh my goodness.
Like, hysterical, and it's just, it makes me smile, because I just feel like work like that is so universal, and
yeah,
it'll never stop being twisted and adapted and changed into like new material.
Do any of you guys follow the SparkNotes account on Twitter?
Yes.
No.
They do this with like memes all the time, where they'll take like, oh, this funny popular meme that's been going around recently, and then they'll like quote Shakespeare or something. And really? It's delightful because it's doing that same sort of work where it's like playing with that material in a new format.
Let me read you one.
Please.
Oh, dear.
So it's at SparkNotes on Twitter if you want to look it up. I don't know who needs to hear this right now, but there's a raven outside your chamber door, and he's got something to say.
I love it. I think it's playful. And then, Becca, you mentioned Ryan North, and I wanted to shout out, he's also got, he wrote the book Romeo and or Juliet, which is a choose-your-own-adventure adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, which is super fun. Yeah.
I believe that led into the creation of the game.
Interesting. Okay. Just one last, because, we're going to say, like,
last thing
about Shakespeare. I am a super huge fan of Ian Desher's Shakespeare adaptations. He does the Shakespearean Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
And then lately he's been adapting other works in verse. So I think last year he had come out Get Thee Back to the Future and Much Ado About Mean Girls. Yeah.
Yes.
And both of those are fun as well. I really like them.
I've not heard about Much Ado About Mean Girls, but...
Oh my god, it is so good, Becca. It is so good.
I didn't know I was going to tell this story. I have a funny story about the Mean Girls adaptation. When I first found out that Ian Desher was going to be doing non-Star Wars-related Shakespearean adaptations, I had first found the Back to the Future one. And Darcy and I were working together one morning at the store, and I had seen it on like Twitter as I was coming into work. And I was like, hey, you'll never guess what Ian Desher is adapting next for as Shakespearean. And she goes, please don't tell me it's Mean Girls. And I was like, no, it's Back to the Future. And I searched Ian Desher in iPage, which is our distributor we use for special orders for books and folks. It's not important for listeners. I'm sorry. But I looked up Ian Desher's name, and the first thing that came up was actually Much Ado About Mean Girls. And I was like, Darcy, how did you... I didn't even know this thing existed when you made that comment, and now here it is coming out the same day as Back to the Future. It was delightful. It was amazing. She conjured it out of thin air. I'm convinced.
Oh, that's apparently. Amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fun. I really like I really like them. And then, you know, we talked about audiobooks last time, but the Shakespearean Star Wars audiobooks are fun because, again, the Star Wars audiobooks already traditionally have like music cues and sound effects and stuff. So what happens at the beginning of the Shakespeare Star Wars ones is it starts with the like fanfare, and then it transitions into like lute music, and like you get the voices of the crowd, like an audience preparing to watch a play, which I think is really fun.
Nice.
Yeah. They're great. They sound great. That guy's so smart. in the Force Awakens one, the Force Doth Awakens, every one of Rey's soliloquies are in iambic pentameter, of course. But they're also acrostic poems questioning who her parentage is because no one knew yet. And so there's like another layer of story going on within these poems. They're like really elaborate in an incredible way.
So, since you have brought up the Star Wars book adaptation sort of, you know, Lane, I did have two notes that I just wanted to make. I think that it's so interesting, even more interesting maybe, when film and television become so popular that comics become, like, comics and books get made based off of it. And the ones that really stick out to me are Steven Universe becoming a comic.
Oh, I love Steven Universe so much.
Yeah.
The She-Ra and the Princesses of Power has become a comic now. And then like Elvira has become like a huge staple in comics.
Oh yeah.
Oh, cool. And
I just think that that's so interesting. Like, I think it's great when like different forms of media gain such like a cult following that it encourages the creation of other kinds of media around it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and we had also talked a little bit about the Adventure Zone and it getting turned into a graphic novel series, a comic series. And I love that too. I think it's really good.
Yeah. There's a... So I'm trying to see if I can find it real quick. In a similar thing, a couple years ago, there was a podcast that did... God, is it called... I'm trying to find the name of it. There was a podcast that came out that was about Wolverine, and it was a fully voiced, like, fictional, like, story. I don't even know if it was an adaptation.
Are you talking about the new Long Night?
Yeah.
Yes, The Long Night. That's what it's called. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Which I think I only listened to the first one, but,
there's also The Lost Trail.
Okay, yeah.
I believe The Lost Trail is season one.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah, they're really fun. And Richard Armitage is the voice. I don't know if you guys know, Richard Armitage was the dude from, oh my goodness, he was in The Hobbit, was he, Thor in Oakenshield?
I think he's Thorin. I know that he's in Castlevania.
He is in Castlevania. I'm gonna Google it real quick.
I'm working on it.
It's okay, we can cut this all out and pretend that we're very knowledgeable.
Always.
Just instantaneous. Yeah, he was blah 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 blah. Yeah, he was Thorin.
Yeah.
Ah, I love Thorin.
And he was Gary in a film called Into the Storm.
I want to go back and listen to that. I'm always... We're doing a... As someone who has experience doing podcasts, I'm always really fascinated to find, like, fictional retail... Like, when something gets adapted into a podcast, I think it's something that you usually see go the opposite direction. We talked about, like, the Welcome to Night Vale show getting books and, like, Adventure Zone getting comics, things like that, but I don't see it go the other way very often.
No. I feel like everyone's too afraid of, like, licensing rights and, like, getting shut down.
Yeah.
I know. Well, I would be.
It's tough. I, wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this or not. I think I have a particular, like, experience with adaptations. The, podcasts I've, there's a group of podcasts, actually, that are under a blanket umbrella called, Movies by Minutes. You can check it out at moviesbyminutes.com. They started years ago with a couple of guys who wanted to talk about the Star Wars movies 1 minute at a time. And so every episode that they put out 5 episodes a week, and every episode is just covering the next minute of film content. And there are now, I think 160 is the time of this recording, podcasts that have done that with other movies. And, some of them have done books. I know that the Princess Bride Minute is run by a couple friends of mine that I really enjoy that one. I have some close friends that also do the Lord of the Rings Minute podcast. They're on their last season right now. They're wrapping up Return of the King. My friend, I have another friend, Victoria. My friend Victoria and I do Harry Potter Minute. And it's really interesting looking at, like, taking a very fine comb through these movies and talking about, like, where the differences lie between these and the books, and, like, how the representations of these characters have changed, and figuring out that, like, there are so many steps involved in adapting a work of fiction into a film, because you have to be picky about what you can show, right? Like, you only have...
I know you had also put Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I did.
One of your things.
So Scott Pilgrim, I put it on my list here because I love that adaptation. I think they do a really good job with what they did in the comics. Scott Pilgrim is particularly interesting because only the first 3 volumes of the comic were out when the film rights were sold. And the movie was being produced at the time that the films were, or that the books were finishing. So the last act of Scott Pilgrim versus the World is completely different in the book than it is in the movie. That's also one my friends and I do Scott Pilgrim Minute over on the Patreon page for Dueling Genre for $1 a month. So if people want to listen to me and my friends yammer about Scott Pilgrim, you can go do that over there. But that one's particularly interesting because Edgar Wright was a big fan of Brian Lee O'Malley's stuff. Not Brian Lee O'Malley. No, it is Brian Lee O'Malley. I thought for a second I got him and Brian K. Vaughan confused because they're both like 3 named Brians. Brian Lee O'Malley and Edgar Wright became friends, and the two of them were like working on the adaptation. Some of the art from the books was just straight animated for cutscenes in the movie.
I think that Scott Pilgrim versus the World is one of the most successful and close to the story adaptations of
really,
a comic or book to a film that I've ever
it's
seen.
It's really like, funny you say that, because I agree. I think that it is one of the most well-done adaptations, but it didn't make any money.
People were not ready for it,
which is unfortunate. I've told the story in other places, but I saw that movie without having even heard of the comics. I just, after work one day at the theater, someone was like, hey, let's go see this, and I didn't know what it was about, and it blew my mind. And then, of course, I devoured all the comics, like, immediately after. But
I'm just, like, envisioning Baby Gary being like, oh, what is this?
Literally, mm-hmm. Yeah, I had no idea. And, but I've gone on, I've become such a big fan of that movie in particular, and the Blu-ray has a really interesting commentary track that is Brian Lee O'Malley and Edgar Wright talking about what writing the movie looked like, and how there are parts in the book and in the movie that, like, neither of them know which came first, like, who wrote that line, or whose idea was it to do this thing. Yeah, because it became collaborative for both sides. Which I think we touched on when we talked about Game of Thrones, I think, in a previous episode. I don't even remember which one it came up in. And about, like, what's going to happen when George R. R. Martin finishes the series. Like, how much is he going to end up taking from what happened with the TV series?
I think he'll honestly change so much because of the... Sure.
But then outrage still going to be, I think there's still going to be a lot of overlap. And it's going to be
I feel like he used it as, like, a what not to do sort of layout. He was like, well, was like, no, I won't do that.
We who knows when we'll find out. Like, we have...
God, we're never going to find out. He's never going to finish the books. He's never going to finish the books.
I don't know.
He's made his money. He's done. He's like, I'm good, yo. And
he was like, I'm over it.
He's going to be like, look, I already know what happened. You guys already, quote unquote, know what happened. We're good.
I don't know.
Just feel like he'll do it to spite us. He'll be like, to the end, he'll be like, I know what happens, but you never will.
I bet the books are already done. I bet they're just sitting somewhere. And he's like, you know what? I know when these will come out. They'll come out the day after I die. And then we just are going to be mad at him. And then, boops, there's two books.
Yeah, so he doesn't have to hear us bitch about it, whether we like it or
right?
not.
He's just going to wait till he dies, and then they're just going to get printed out. And
I'm just going to say it, because I guess that I like to use this podcast to say things about myself that I don't want people to know.
I have
never consumed a single slice, not a minute, of Game of Thrones, like, ooh, anything. Oh, I just, like, the fandom is so excruciating to me. Like, I just can't.
Oh, for sure.
Like, they ruined it for me before I even knew what it was.
I read the books in high school, and then the show happened, and I don't think I watched the show until the last season was airing. Oh, and I just blew through the whole thing.
I saw the first season before I read any of it, and then I was like, well, I'll read it, because I like some of these characters. The other ones can shove off. Yeah. And I like... The first season and the first book are super close together.
Yeah.
Like, I could, like, quote dialogue as we were rewatching it, and it was exactly how it was in the book. And it's kind of the same in the second, and then it really starts teetering off, and I'm like, well... Yeah.
And I have even gone so far as to be like, should we make a podcast where we watch the last episode and then try to figure out how they got there, and then just do that for the entire show?
It won't make sense how they got there, because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in the show. You're like, wait, how did he get
character
there?
Development,
and I don't understand this. Yeah. And dude,
so what I'm hearing is it's a good idea.
What I'm hearing is you guys are probably going to need a lot of
that sounds punishing
drinks, whether they are adult or not. To help you get through it.
Oh my god.
I have to do that with, like,
the last episode of the second to last season.
Yes, yeah. That I think would be good. I think you need to ignore the last season.
Oh, so it's like Arrested Development, where you just pretend that the last season didn't happen. Oh,
god, pretend it didn't happen. Watch the end of, what is it, the sixth season? Watch that last episode and try to figure it out from there. Because at least that ending makes a little bit of sense.
A little bit.
A little bit.
I don't know.
I don't want to spend too long on Game of Thrones, but the thing that I always found super interesting was, like, when the show was first happening, everyone was losing their minds over God, what is the oldest? Who's the oldest son? Rob. Over Rob Stark. And Rob Stark never has a POV chapter in the books. It's everything that happens to Rob Stark happens through the eyes of his mother. It's always her chapters. No, they're all Catelyn chapters.
They aren't. Wow. Yeah.
And so I really didn't like Rob when I read the book.
I thought he was very, like, one-note, kind of just two-dimensional. Yeah.
And then when you see him in the show, I think they did a really great... I think I like his portrayal in the show much better than I do in the books. And that's interesting, because that doesn't happen very often. Usually, I want to be the person championing, like, no, go read the books, because they're going to have the most authentic, like, whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How do you guys feel... You know, I've already said it in this episode. I worked at a movie theater before I worked at the bookstore. And between both jobs, the thing that happens all the time is, like, do you read the book first or do you watch the movie first?
I don't feel like it matters.
I totally, 9 times out of 10, read the book first. The only reason I say 9 times out of 10 is Ready Player One is the one movie I have watched the movie first before reading the book.
That's an interesting one to...
For me, if I can help it, I try to watch the movie and then read the book. The reason for that is if I do it the other way, I actually get disappointed with the movie. Then, oh, it didn't have this, or this was different. But if I do it the other way, then I go, oh, that was a lot more in the book. It was more enriching. It works with my frame of thinking that I feel better because I got more than, wow, this was lacking.
Nick, I'm right here with you with that. When I started in the theater, I very much preferred reading the book first, but I do think that, like, I tend to enjoy both more if I watch the movie first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't have the baggage of, like, this is what I think the movie should be.
Correct.
And then when I read the book, I get to get just more immersed and more involved with who these characters are. And so I tend to come out and join both.
I'm trying to remember, like, the last time I made an effort to read the book before the movie. Because I used to be very, like, the book is going to be better. And I would want to read it first. But then I kind of stopped thinking about them as either or.
Yeah,
that was my problem with it. I just feel like whichever one I run into first is the one I'm going to consume first, and, like, that's that.
And, like, there are definitely things that I've watched that have made me go read the books. Like, Outlander is probably the number one making me go read the books, because it helped me commit to those 800, 900 page books.
Absolutely.
But, like right now, too, I'm watching Little Fires Everywhere on Hulu. Which is amazing, but I have not read the book. And I feel that is one where I'm like, I kind of wish I had read the book, but it's still so good that I don't know. It's so good. I can't recommend it enough. But I don't know. They're their own things. I guess I did go back and reread The Great Gatsby before the Baz Luhrmann movie came out, because I wanted to make sure that I didn't like the book as much as I remembered. And I didn't, but I liked the movie better.
Interesting.
Soundtrack does a lot of work.
I read the book right before the movie, and I had never read it before. And I enjoyed it more than I expected to. And then
the book or the movie?
Both, actually. I thought that it was going to be, you know, like, Great Gatsby is one of those, like, required high school reads for a lot of people. And it just wasn't for me. And I always... My experience with, like, books you're required to read in school has always been, like, very hit or miss. I was just really surprised that I enjoyed that book.
I hate, with every fiber of my being, anything to do with The Crucible. I had to read that book or the play or the film adaptation. Guys, I had to consume that piece of media 12 times in the 4 years of high school because of English and theater. Like, I can't stand it. It's all bad. I hate it.
That's how I am with Romeo and Juliet. My high school, we did Shakespeare every year. And I'm not even kidding. Every year they picked Romeo and Juliet. I'm so tired of seeing Leonardo DiCaprio's Romeo and Juliet I will literally break a TV if it's on in front of me because I hate that movie with every fiber of my soul.
I haven't seen it.
You're not missing out.
You're not missing anything.
It doesn't sound anything like it.
Other than Mercutio, who's the only good part of that movie.
Yeah, that was definitely not one of the best adaptions, in my opinion. Oddly enough, one of my favorite adaptions, which is not even a faithful adaption, is The Shining.
Yes!
I love The Shining.
Oh, yeah.
Directed by Stanley Kubrick, who just seemed to do so many adaption movies. He did Clockwork Orange. He did Full Metal Jacket.
Another good one.
2001 Space Odyssey. For The Shining alone, that one, Stephen King has of course gone out to say that he hated what they did to the movie. And he's even described Stanley Kubrick and himself like, well, I'm very fire and passion and Stanley is very cold and ice, which really shows honestly
in the movie
because spoiler alert, the hotel.
I don't think it's a spoiler. It's been a while.
I don't know. There's still some people who are going to argue.
Like a sell-by date.
So, yes. even then, just spoiler everyone who's listening. Maybe skip 30 seconds a minute. The hotel burns down in the book, and in the movie, the main character Jack Nicholson freezes to death as his ultimate end. Mm-hmm. Like, what juxtaposition? And of course, in the book, it is very blatant. Horror paranormal, wherein in the movie you're like, okay, is this really happening? Is this psychological? And then it turns out, oh, you know, there is paranormal stuff, but for the most time you think that he's just going crazy, whereas he's going crazy but also ghosts.
I mean, I'm not trying to be anti what you're saying, but I think that Stanley Kubrick is such a like overrated director. Like, he treated those actors like absolute garbage, and what's her name,
the one who played Shelley the wife
Duvall.
yeah
Shelley Duvall, she didn't act again because of how psychologically damaged she was by him.
He scared the crap out of her.
He was so awful to her, and he like was so awful to so many of them. And like, when he died, they found obsessive like piles and piles of just like hoarded information that he kept in his mansion for movies that he never even ended up doing. Like, the man was obsessive to such an unhealthy degree.
Well, despite that, it obviously shows in the final product, because the final product is, in my opinion, really good. All those movies, like I mentioned, and even a little tidbit, or just weird trivia, Clockwork Orange, Gary, you had mentioned, the comic, that you watched the movie and then you read the comic.
Scott Pilgrim.
So you mentioned Scott Pilgrim was both loyal until like the end, which was completely different. Oddly enough, and a few people know this, in Clockwork Orange, the actual book that was first published in England, that one has a 21st chapter that was never published until like last decade, two decades, with in America and some other countries without that 21st chapter.
Huh.
And the reason for that is because in the 21st chapter, another spoiler alert, the main character, who is just a B word, they actually make him sympathetic and have almost like a redemption for his bad ways.
Where
that's the whole 21st chapter. In the American and other country version with the only 20 chapters, they leave it on bad guy is the ultimate winner ending. Because and this is what one producer or one publisher in New York said when they were doing that, when they cut the chapter, this is American audiences. We don't want to have a happy ending. They want to have the unhappy ending. Cause we can take it. And then that's ultimately what they did for the movie. For the movie, they only did everything up to the 20th chapter, there was no good ending. There was no redemption. They left it on a twisted, uh-oh, here we go again.
Have you guys ever... What about adaptations that are only, like... I don't want to say partial adaptations, but I'm specifically thinking of... have you guys seen the movie The Prestige? The Christopher Nolan
yes.
film?
Yes.
No. I found out years after I saw that movie for the first time that it's based on a book. And
oh, yeah.
half that book takes place in the present day. Huh. And it is in the film. The book deals with, like, the descendants of those guys. And, like, what happened to the machine. And it's just not part of the movie at all. And they're both fascinating, but they're telling completely different stories.
Oh, no, that was really fascinating.
I guess another question kind of I wanted to ask you guys, too, is, like, how important is fidelity to you when you're watching an adaptation? Because...
I think I'm going to be the odd one that says as long as the final product on the adaptation is sound, entertaining, and is a good one, I don't mind if it diverges a lot from the original source material.
I'm all with you, Nick.
I was gonna say, I absolutely agree.
But then there's always those people who are like, no, you weren't loyal, there wasn't this, there wasn't that.
See, I'm okay with there being changes as long as they make sense. What bugs me the most is, and I remember because this was about Twilight, and it was the color of her car. And they changed the color of her car. And I'm like, that is a stupid change. I ranted about that for, I think, 20 minutes to my husband. Because I'm like, that is ridiculous. I don't care if you change how she meets people. I don't care if you change what month it is, but it's literally the color of a car. You take a can of spray paint and you make it right.
Why are you mentioning that?
Why are you precious about that? Like,
because the little changes that make no sense at why you couldn't get them right bother me more than if you change a bigger moment.
I mean, there's so much.
I think that it's interesting that you bring that up because, like, it reminded me. I don't know if any of you guys read the Vampire Diaries series, but in it, Elena was the blonde, and the other girl, her name is escaping me.
I don't remember it.
She was the brunette, the, like, other, like, one of the, like, other main girls. Yeah. And they switched it for the TV series, and I thought that it worked really well, but I just never understood. Why?
See, that could make sense to me because
Caroline, that was her name, sorry.
If the actresses they got were naturally a blonde or brunette, they might not want to be, like, bleaching their hair or wearing a wig that entire time. So it's
that made it confusing to me because I felt like both of the actresses could have easily portrayed the other girl equally as well. Mm. So it was just like one of those things that, like, it didn't make sense to me. I was like, I don't see why you did this. It doesn't really bother me, but.
Now, this particular problem I have is predominantly with series, mostly television shows. I hate it when they do an adaption and they change the source material so much just because they want to keep. Oh, that's my clock. I'm just going to let it run. Da, da, da.
Da, 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 da. Your clock's 5 minutes fast.
It's 5 minutes slow. Yeah, I'm just gonna wait. So almost there. It's almost there. All right. So I have a So it's a big issue with especially series that will change a source material so much just because they want to keep the series going. We can make a ton more money if we keep it going. So let's change this, even though it diverges and doesn't make sense, but it makes sense for us because we need to keep the series going.
Well, yeah, I think that with TV shows, they especially have that problem because, I mean, I guess TV shows don't necessarily work the same way they used to, but for a long time, the goal for any TV series was to get syndicated because then you can play on other networks and you're always going to collect royalties on that show. But that doesn't happen until you have 100 episodes. But I think it's always more... I'm more forgiving of adaptations in movies than I am with TV, I think, because I know that there's, like... The time constraint of the movie, but also, like, there's so much work that goes into making a film, and there could be any number of little things that you don't expect to affect the film in the way it does.
No, that's fair.
I really, really liked the Terry Goodkind sort of truth books in high school. And there was a... I mean, I was going to say low budget. I don't know what the budget for the show was. There was an adaptation that came out when I was in... God, it must have been like 2007, 2008, called Legend of the Seeker. And Terry Goodkind was involved with the writing process of the show. And then they changed things like... Spoilers for Legend of the Seeker, but... the bad guy who's supposed to be the main character's dad turns out to be his brother. And... like things like that are changed, like big significant plot points about who characters are and what their relationships are, where it feels like it's an entirely different thing now. And that was something that I like had a really hard time with when that show was coming out. I ended up giving up on it before it finished because it was just tonally an entirely different thing.
You know where that doesn't happen a lot?
Hmm.
This is the last thing I really wanted to talk about, so.
Ooh.
Anime and manga.
Yes!
Most of the time. Thank you, Gary. Most of the time, the anime is desperately trying to catch up with the manga. I know I talked a little bit earlier about how, like, comic shops in America don't see an increase in sales of comic books when, like, comic adaptation film and television comes out, but that is not the case in the Japanese entertainment. When a popular manga comes out and an anime adaptation happens, they see huge sale increases in the sale of the manga that it's adapted from, because when manga becomes an anime, it opens up a whole new audience, specifically, like, American audiences. Like, you know, I'm sure you guys are aware of the huge boom in appreciation for Japanese culture that's happening in America the, like, past, I don't know, 5-6 years. And I know that everyone sitting here at least knows the name Naruto because that series is so popular.
I was going to specifically mention it because I watched Naruto a lot as a kid, and I got to that point where I was caught up with the show and I wanted to know what was coming next. And then I went and found the manga.
Well, it's funny you say that, because that's the exact reason is, like, whereas American comics can be really daunting because of the different universes and stuff, most manga is pretty straightforward.
They're self-contained. And they don't really, like, cross it's very over self-contained. The way American comics do.
I would say Naruto is one of those cases because there is, like, Shippuden and then Boruto and all of those, like, continuations. It's a little less contained, but the most recent one I want to bring up, because I feel like there's been a huge phenomena with it, is the series Beastars on Netflix.
I haven't watched it yet. Do you know if it's good? I hope it's good.
I watched the whole thing in one sitting.
Okay, I'm gonna watch it then. Thank you, Becca, for giving me my weekend watch.
Guys, audience, fellow podcasters, if you have not watched it, I do recommend it. It's a very sweet series. But the manga has become super popular now too, because people are, like, chomping at the bit to get more information and more of the characters. And I just think that the comparison for, like, readers to viewers is that, like, comic book readers, manga readers, they're way more apt to pick up the television and film than vice versa.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think that people that read these characters are going to be more engaged with, like, going and seeking out the adaptation, whereas people who just passively watch something, oh, hey, the new Marvel movie is out, let's go see Endgame or Civil War or whatever, those folks are probably not going to go and find the comics afterwards.
Or, like, if they do, I feel like half the time it's, like, one guy wants to, like, point out one time that Captain Marvel didn't do thing. And 100%. So you did it entirely wrong.
Yeah. I think anime is particularly interesting because I know that, like, specifically I keep thinking about Full Metal Alchemist because there are two different shows that are adapting that comic because the first one sort of does
more. There's two different comic series as well.
No, I was unaware of that part.
Yeah, Brotherhood is separate from the...
I didn't know they were different comics.
Yeah, and I believe Brotherhood also has novel adaptations as well.
Interesting.
I know that there's more than one way to consume the Fullmetal Alchemist series. What I was going to bring up, because I just thought of it, I bet most of you have seen Sailor Moon, the cartoon, but the manga...
story of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like, everyone's super familiar. It's, like, a huge cultural phenomena. Like, I grew up with it. I love it. The thing I didn't grow up with was the manga to follow, because the manga didn't get widespread American release, and still hasn't, really. And, so it's one of those rare instances where, like, the material came to America, did super, super well, but then we weren't given more, even though we wanted it.
Sure. I think it's tough to, like, especially when it comes to, like, anime adaptations and manga adaptations. Like, I know that at one point I was so desperate to stay caught up with Naruto as they were coming out that I was reading just, like, fan translations or transcriptions because, like,
it's gonna be
so long until the English version of this manga is available for me to read. I don't read Japanese, but hey, this fan in Japan has done a thing on his website. I'll go read it there. And, like, I don't know how trustworthy those translations are, but, like, it still allowed me to engage in that material when I wouldn't have been able to otherwise. What about, not only, like, one-to-one adaptations, but, like, before The Witcher show, we got The Witcher video games. But The Witcher video games take place after the end of the novels. They're, like, a continuation of the story. They're not an adaptation of it. I mean, they're an adaptation of it, but they're not a retelling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling a different story with those same characters. Which I find very interesting. I only played the third Witcher game, so, like, my experience with the continuity of Witcher is all sorts of bananas, because I played that game, and then I watched the show, and now I'm reading the books. So I'm very much going backwards, I think, through the material, and thoroughly enjoying it. I think that all three of those adaptations are all very good for very different reasons. Guys, I really like The Witcher.
Well, like, what that, I think, also just shows us is, like, what, you know, adaptation can be when adaptation takes advantage of the media that it's translating something to, which isn't always the case, right? Things are not always translated across media, but a lot of what we're talking about is.
Yeah.
And I don't know, personally, I think that makes it cool when, you know, the person doing the adapting kind of takes advantage of the different technology as a way of adding to the story. Like, this isn't, I'm not going to give a spoiler away, but, like, this week's episode of Outlander worked in some stuff about silent film.
Oh.
And used kind of silent film filming techniques as part of the story for one of the characters. And it was really cool, I thought. And
that's fun.
Like, that's not something that you can just do when you're only working. Like, that's something that is possible for film that isn't necessarily possible for
it's
like a book.
I think it's really fun to see. Yeah, specifically what you're saying. When you adapt a piece of material into a different medium, you suddenly have a whole new toy box to play with.
Exactly.
One of the things that I really, really love about The Witcher video games is that, like, the world is full of, like, just really good side quests that you can do. Just, like, one-off characters that are going to point you in a direction of a story that is unrelated to the main plot, but gives you that same sense of just being the person who goes around and fights monsters and solves people's problems, which is very much what the first couple books do. Though the books are, the first two books in the series are the short story collections. Chronologically, they're the first two in the series. And each section, each short story is just, here's Geralt in another point in time doing a deed for this person who's paying him to go fight this monster or whatever. And engages in a very different way. Whereas, like, you know, the TV series is what, 8 episodes? And so, or 13 maybe? And you have to, even if you're not going to be like telling the story in a linear fashion, you still need to have a narrative through line. Whereas a video game gives you the space to tell a bunch of little stories. And you might have like an overarching main quest, but you could spend potentially hundreds of hours doing other things. That I really, really enjoy. Those games are so good. I didn't realize I was going to talk about The Witcher so much on this one, you guys. But I wanted to get away from talking about only Harry Potter, because I've talked
That's
a lot
fine.
About
Harry. We haven't even mentioned Harry Potter.
So much about Harry Potter.
We, like, briefly touched it.
Guys, go search Harry Potter Minute and listen to me talk too much about Harry Potter.
See, there we go.
I don't know. I guess I know Victoria wanted to talk about this too, but adaptations that... like I really love, and I think this kind of speaks to what we're talking about when people can take advantage of the media that they're translating into.
Yeah.
Is Jane Austen, but like specifically Joe Wright, who also did Atonement, and I believe he did Anna Karenina.
Uh-huh.
Which are all adaptations, and I think that I love the adaptations personally.
Okay, so Jenny, question.
Okay,
and this is one? Very important. Very important. Our friendship in the Red Pandas depend on
your
God.
Answer. Oh God, this is so much pressure.
It is. Colin Firth or Matthew McFadden?
They're different. They're not the same. And this is, okay, this is, goes back to what I was originally saying, right, about the order in which you experience things. The first iteration of Pride and Prejudice, I'm pretty sure that I ever saw and or read, was Bridget Jones's Diary.
Really?
Yes.
Ugh. And I think it's which so was written, funny that Colin Firth is in that.
Well, that's how she wrote it.
But he's Helen also Fielding, in the TV series.
Helen Fielding wrote Mark Darcy's character with Colin Firth's portrayal of Mr. Darcy in mind. Like, if you read in the book, she talks about Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy all the time.
Oh, see, now I have to read that.
Yeah, so, like, thinking, like, weird backwards channels.
Right? So,
I love Colin Firth, but in some ways, I love him as Mark Darcy, the best in Bridget Jones's Diary, because that is always...
See,
I don't know, I love him in that.
I saw Bridget Jones's Diary before I realized it had any connection to Pride and Prejudice. And I was like, what is this? I'm not really digging it. I don't understand what's going on. And then I was looking at the book and I was like, wait a minute. This is so Pride and Prejudice. And then I rewatched it and liked it so much better because I have just this weird obsession with Pride and Prejudice. Like,
it gives you a frame of reference.
The first time I saw anything related to Pride and Prejudice was the Keira Knightley, Matthew McFadden.
Yeah.
Yes. I am in love with
Matthew McFadden only as Mr. Darcy. Like, otherwise, I'm like, this man is not it for me.
But when he was on that in the Howard's End miniseries that came out like a couple years ago.
I don't know if it's just because like Mr. Darcy like ticks off a lot of the boxes of interest for me and like broody characters, but like when Matthew McFadden puts on that coat and he's like, I love you, go away. I'm like, oh my God.
You're like, okay. I think he plays it totally differently than Colin Firth. But I don't know. I love one of the things I love about that adaptation is the last scene where you they give you a glimpse into Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy's kind of private life post wedding because Jane Austen doesn't write the post wedding scenes.
It just feels so intimate and so private. Like, I shouldn't be there.
And totally,
I love that.
It's in the spirit of the book and the movie so much, though, that like I love that it's added. I know.
No, I love both the TV series one and the 2005 film so much. And for me, Matthew, it hurts saying it almost, but he's almost more Mr. Darcy than Colin. And I don't know if that's because I've seen that one more than the TV series.
I have seen it more by this point.
And I mean, I would, anytime this movie was on, I'd watch it. Again, that boils down to I'm obsessed with Pride and Prejudice, and I don't have enough copies of any Pride and Prejudice. Please ignore the 20 copies and of Pride and Prejudice / adaptations that are on my shelf right now.
going back to a humorous adaptations, what did you guys think of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies? Because I really loved the book. I had a great time.
I couldn't get through the book, but I liked the movie. I liked the movie. I couldn't read the book. I tried five times.
I haven't seen the movie, but I read the book and I enjoyed it.
I want to be able to get through the book. I'm pretty sure I own a copy of the book. I just haven't been able to get through it.
Have you guys seen Warm Bodies?
I love Warm Bodies.
Guys, I don't want to say I'm stupid, but I didn't realize until the very end that it was like Romeo and Juliet adaptation. Like, literally, I, like, remember looking at my partner, David, and being like, wait, her name's Julia? I don't know, man. I'm really
part of me wants to be like, how did you not get that? Because I think she even calls him, like, Romeo.
No, she calls him R.
His name's R.
It's just R.
And it's just like...
It wasn't clear enough for me. It just wasn't clear enough.
Well, Warm Bodies is fun also because, like... That's also a novel that got made into a movie.
Yes.
It's a YA by Isaac Marion. There's a couple of them, actually. I think there's like two or three. But the author came into Mysterious Galaxy. He did a signing with us like a couple years ago now. But before his signing events were happening, he showed up at the store and was like, hey, I have... like arcs of the newest, like the third book or whatever it is. If you want to, like, I'll sign arcs and I'll let you guys have some arcs. And then I'm hoping to do a tour whenever the book comes out. And he told us that he had like, he had a van and he had been driving down the coast, visiting independent bookstores and giving them copies of his arc so that they would bring him for his tour. And it was amazing. Aww. He was really cool. I gave those to my sister because my sister really loves Warm Bodies, and it was just a really cool experience. He was a great guy.
Sweet.
Guys, go read Warm Bodies. Support Isaac Marion.
Right.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna have to read it now. I had no idea.
I'll have to add it to my list.
Yeah.
Even though Romeo and Juliet irks me, I will have to add it to my list.
I feel like it's different enough that I can justify it.
I think so too. I've not read them, but I like the movie a lot.
Wow, you really pushed it, and then we're like, I
know,
read it.
I know. Here's the thing. Here's the bad thing about being a bookseller is like when you have an author event with an author that's super cool, and you're like, I'm sorry, I've never read your stuff. Yeah, but you are great.
One of my biggest fears at conventions is when I have to like help run author signings and I don't know who any of the people are, and or like I know the name but not what they look like, and when they come up and I'm just like, hey, are you trying to buy a book? And they're like, no, I'm doing an event. Oh, cool, I'll just die.
I don't think I've told this story on this podcast before, but two years ago, I was working with the Disney Lucasfilm Press at the Star Wars booth during Comic-Con, and they're right next to the Del Rey booth. And Timothy Zahn was signing copies of Thrawn at the Del Rey booth, but I didn't know what Timothy Zahn looked like. And he came up to the booth to like he picked up some books. He was like poking around. The two of us ended up talking for like 10 minutes, just like about other Star Wars content. And then the guy at Del Rey was like, oh, hey, like, are you ready for your signing? I was like, oh my God, that was Timothy Zahn. And I didn't even know.
How did you not know?
I'm happy to say that I've had the same experience happen. I went to a house party at David's boss's house. My partner, David, works for IDW Publishing. And, you know, so there were people there that work in comics. What I failed to realize was the nice gentleman, Kevin, that I was talking to all night was Kevin Eastman, the creator of Ninja Turtles.
Oh, man.
And I
had a little bit too much to drink at that party. And I guess the end of the night, as he was leaving, I just thanked him. Like, I just looked at this man and was like, thank you.
I was like, thank you.
And he was just like, uh-huh.
He's like, and never coming back here again.
Yeah, but that was definitely, like, the most embarrassing, like, oh, shit, that person is, like, a legend, and I had no idea.
See, at least, like, this, the person I'm about to talk about has nothing to do with books at all, but at least you could verbalize to him. I was at Ducks Day for the Anaheim Ducks at Disney California Adventure, and I was on a ride sitting right next to my favorite hockey player.
Oh.
Couldn't get two words out of my mouth. I could not make any words come out of my mouth.
I couldn't even imagine.
Not even hello. There were no words.
We had George R. R. Martin sign stock for us in the store once. He came in before, he was doing an event, I think at UCSD or something. But he came in before opening just to sign stock. We ordered a bunch of books in so we'd have signed copies to sell to customers. And I could not work up the courage to say anything to this man. I was like, you probably get this all the time. You're working. I'm working. Like, I don't want to be like the little fanboy. Because he was just like sitting in one of the chairs beneath the TV, like on his phone, like doing his own thing. Because he had already finished signing by the time I got to the store. And so I left him alone, and then I just bought signed copies after he left.
Aww.
Couldn't do it, guys. It's big pressure.
I don't want to say for sure, but I'm pretty sure that he's a family friend of David's family.
Amazing. Somehow I'm not surprised.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Considering David's family, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
At all.
I remember when we first got together and he, like, called R.L. Stein like Rob or something, and I was like,
you know, like, Rob, him.
It's wild. Wow.
I want to call R.L. Stein Rob.
Right?
We've gotten off.
Excuse me. I was wrong. He just texted me from the other room and said that he called him Bob. It's Bob Stein.
Even worse.
Even more.
Gosh.
Sometimes I just literally am like, what is my life? That my partner's like, oh yeah, you know, Bob Stein that wrote those kids horror books.
And you're like, uh-huh.
I think we had him sign at Comic-Con a couple years ago too.
I think so.
It was his first time at Comic-Con the year before last.
Wow.
His first time ever. And the reason why is because they wanted to actually give him an Inkpot Award, which they did for his very first and so far only Comic-Con.
Wow. That's amazing.
I love that.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we've strayed really far from talking about adaptations.
I think so, too.
Oh, yeah. We have like
been recording for like an hour and a half.
Yeah. I think so.
Is there anything else about adaptation specifically that people would like to bring up before we start wrapping up?
I mean, I can keep going, but
Nick, I know you wanted to talk about Neil Gaiman.
Well, so did Victoria, but he is the man that can pretty much has had his hand in just about everything he can. He's written for comics. He's done books. Mm-hmm. He's done children's books, middle grade. Does he have a YA? I don't think he has a YA.
I don't think he does. I think it's middle grade and children stuff primarily, and then like adult fantasy.
But pretty much everything he has ever written has been adapted, except into video games. And the reason for that, which he has talked about, is every time he tries to do a video game, the company goes out of business.
Video games are tough.
So he thinks he's jinxed, and that every time someone says yes to him in a video game, he, you know, puts them out of business.
It's wild. And,
it's a curse.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But especially with Neil Gaiman, one of my favorite adaptions has to be, well, American Gods comes second. American Gods, the TV show, because people either love it or hate it. I particularly like it, the gritty kind of sexy look that they made in the book. Mm-hmm. And the book is kind of sexy. It has its sexy moments. But,
oh, it absolutely does.
I'm sorry, but as soon as you said that, all I could think of was like that scene from the first book towards the beginning.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But what about you? Safe for work episode, so I won't talk about it.
But what about you, Victoria? What would you like to say about Mr. Gaiman?
Mr. Gaiman, you know, I really like what they've done, at least in the first season. I haven't watched the second of American Gods.
Yeah.
But hands down, my favorite of his is Stardust.
Stardust is so amazing. Fun.
Hands down.
That like, movie is all so of, funny.
It's so good.
All of the characters are almost exactly like what I pictured. Even the stupid one that I share my name with. I hate her. But I really like, even like they're the Sky Lightning Pirates. I loved all of them.
Yeah. It's so good.
Oh, for me, Coraline. Coraline is my number one.
Coraline's another really good one.
Even though it was written as a middle grade novel, it is still pretty creepy for adults. And as a quote unquote children's movie, it is still creepy. Either you're a kid or adult. And I loved it. Great animation. I thought it
That film is stunning. Mm-hmm.
It's like one of Laika's first productions too, right? Like they're still doing stop motion animation, and it's incredibly intensive. The work.
I don't know if any of you guys got to go to the Laika studio, little like
gallery. I wanted to.
We did, and it was absolutely like they let you get like alarmingly close to the stuff. Like I was almost like maybe we shouldn't be allowed to almost touch it. Like it made me really scared because I was like, I know I'm responsible, but
wow.
Yeah. I haven't read or watched Good Omens yet, but I hear Good Omens is great.
It is.
I watched the first two episodes. I haven't read it though yet.
Yeah.
Oh, great book. Definitely great book.
I read it a long time ago, but I just started watching the series, and I really enjoy Michael Sheen.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm
I think we got the
and David Tennant
characters.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any other game and adaptations that I want to shout out, but I think we touched the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. I think that's it for adaptation stuff. Before we wrap, does anyone want to talk about like what their to-be-read pile is like right now? What are you guys reading?
Well, I'm still reading Last Girls. I haven't really had time to actually read at all. And then next is actually going to be, I'm putting it before The Court of Miracles, is going to be Girls Save the World in this one.
Oh,
which
I
is about
supposed to be really
yes.
good.
And it's going to be our fantastic first pick for April, or was, depending on when this comes out. It was our fantastic first pick. And it's about, I want to say it's about girls who are at like this Comic-Con-esque type thing, but it's for zombies.
Oh.
And then real zombies break out.
Oh, that sounds fun.
So
Currently, I'm in the middle of reading Tamsin Muir's Harrow the Ninth sequel to
Eating
a Nine. I'm loving it. And I think it's about time, especially with the current political slash pandemic climate. I think it's time I reread Battle Royale by Kushin Takami, one of the original Battle Royale books. And it's in the title.
Jenny, what are you reading?
I might have to reread that one, too.
I just finished yesterday Night Pleasures by Sherilyn Kenyon. Shout out to Yay! Victoria for the recommendation. And it was great.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I loved it. And I'm really excited to keep reading the series. But I'm also taking at least an interlude from romance, because I've been reading quite a lot of romance recently. And I just started reading The Glass Hotel by Emily St. John Mandel.
Oh.
Which I'm like 3 pages in, but so far so good.
I have passed the halfway point now in Chris Rocchio's The Howling Dark. It's been so good. I'm past the halfway point in the audiobook, which means I still have 13 and a half hours to go. So it'll be a little while before I finish it probably. But I'm really enjoying this one. It's interesting. There's a weird bias that the main character has that I keep butting up against that, like, I don't think I agree with. That's been very strange. Usually protagonist characters are, you would like them to be someone that you identify with. And the thing that he keeps butting up against over and over in this particular book is that, the human empire that is spanning the galaxy have very much sort of shunned like not technological advancement, but like cybernetics and stuff. They're sort of very anti like transhumanism. And they've gotten to a point. Yeah. There's like a religious institution called the Chantry that is very much about like preserving humanity as it was, kind of deal. And so they really like are very against the idea of people like modifying their bodies through tech. But something that I keep butting up against in this book is that like now they are exploring territories that are outside the reach of the empire, and then coming up across what they call extra solarians, these groups of people that are outside of the human empire. And a lot of those groups are people that are have very much modified their bodies in various ways. And there's like a fear about it. And I keep waiting for the moment in this book where Hadrian Marlowe is going to realize that he's wrong, and it's not happening. Every time he comes up against these groups, these peoples, just continually are proven that no, his bias might be right, and I don't think I like that. It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
I don't know. It sounds like very allegoric to transphobia.
100%. Yeah. So I'm having some trouble with it at this point. You know, like he's got a friend who has a neural implant that he has like come around on. But they had a conversation in one of the last chapters that I read. They got to a orbital station, and on the station there was a being that just looked like a giant humanoid, like a spider almost, like multiple arms. And he and his friend, the one with the implant, were walking around, and she was like, "Why are you so afraid of these people? Like, are you afraid of me?" And his response was like, "Well, you're not a giant spider, Beck." And it's like, no, like,
you're missing the point.
Yeah. And I keep waiting for that to change or something to, like, alter his opinion. And it just, I haven't gotten there yet. Everything else in the series I've really enjoyed so far. But, like, just his headspace about this particular issue is something that time and time again is really frustrating me. But it's good, and I really like the guy who reads it. Sam Rukin does a really great job and brings like a real gravitas to Hadrian's character. And it's fun because it is an extrapolation of like Earth culture into space. So like even though it takes place tens of thousands of years after present day, he'll still reference, like, biblical texts. They were talking about Goya's painting of Saturn devouring his children.
I love that painting.
It's fascinating. Some of the stuff that, like, are still touchstones for their culture, even tens of thousands of years later. It's been good, but it's also... I have a complicated relationship with this book right now.
It seems like it.
Seems like it.
But it's been good. I recommend it for anyone who likes space fantasy. It's unlike anything else I've read. What about you, Becca? What are you reading?
I thought someone else had not gone.
I think you're the last one.
Much to everyone's delight, I'm going to read a Neil Gaiman book.
Ooh.
Yay!
Which
I'm
going
to read Black Orchid.
Oh, yeah.
David posed it to me as the Poison Ivy story that I've always wanted, but I, like, have never gotten. And I was instantly sold. I mean, anything that I can look at and be like...
on Poison Ivy.
I was going to say, just go back a couple episodes, you'll know exactly how I feel about Poison Ivy.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so I am going to be reading that. I'm excited, a little nervous since I've been so hit and miss with Gaiman, but
sure,
we will see. Otherwise, I'm just keeping up with Lore Olympus on Webtoons, and yeah, that's it for now.
Awesome.
Anyone else have any other closing thoughts or things they'd like to talk about?
I think this is going to be our longest episode.
Oh,
probably.
So far.
Probably.
It was fun. This is a good one. Becca, do you want to close this out?
I do. Sorry, I was looking for my notes with all of
the
names and everything. I just want to say thank you so much for listening to all of our listeners. As always, you can purchase a lot of the books that we've spoken about today on mistgalaxy.com. Links will be in the description to anything that we've talked about. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at mistgalaxybooks. I want to say thank you to our wonderful music provider, Austin Farmer. Our intro and outro music is from the Bookshelf Symphony Orchestra. You can find that on Spotify. Go give it a listen. It's absolutely fantastic. We'll see you again soon in a galaxy not so far away.